sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear Barry Kissin's very informative speech from the September 2013 9/11 conference in Washington, D.C. It's on the anthrax attacks. He's introduced here by our local 9/11 truth activist, Frank Tolupko. So let's begin.
Okay, the anthrax letter attacks, or better known as the Ameritrax, which is the FBI codename for their so-called investigation. They were initially linked to the putative hijackings of September 11th, 2001, a continuation of the terror, in other words. When the case became muddled and riddled with contradictions and lies, it was quickly decoupled from 911 and blamed on one man, Bruce Ivins. We have the pleasure for the next speaker, an actual terrorist, to talk about this issue. Barry Kissin was named as a terrorist by the State of Maryland Homeland Security Department. Without further ado, and I'm sure you want to hear him, is Barry Kissin.
Thank you. This privilege of speaking to you has caused me to sort of immerse myself in this stuff. And there's a side of it that's terrifying and very sad, because we really are under the control of people who think war is the answer. We're there. And they're not just controlling military policy. They're controlling the ball of wax pretty effectively, right through it all, economics and the politics and the culture and the religion. So my experience of figuring out the anthrax attacks just puts me face to face with what these people do. The anthrax, in the letters sent to the senators, has a trillion spores in 1 gram. That's about half the weight of a dime. A trillion spores. And they're engineered so that most of them, when liberated, like out of an envelope, escape as single spores. The Senate office building, they open up the Daschle letter in Daschle's office on the 6th floor. They open up that envelope. Good estimate is a half a gram of this stuff gets out. There's 2 grams in the envelope, we know that. But a half a gram gets out, if that. The Hart office building is closed. This is the office building for 50 US senators. It's closed for 3 months, costs $42 million to decontaminate. This half a gram, half a trillion spores, is all over a 6-story building that is a square block. The FBI, when it announced this ridiculous conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt, they stressed it, that Bruce Ivins was solely responsible for the anthrax letters, conducted a science briefing, to be exact, 18 days after, it's 19 days, after Bruce Ivins died, 12 days after Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeff Taylor got up in front of the world and said, we got our man. At this science briefing, where all the prestigious science journalists were present, bottom line, takes the position that how this stuff was processed doesn't contribute at all to figuring out who did it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, let's put it this way. The inability of the scientific journalists to pierce through that is pitiful. But that's the state of things. Now, of course, the other thing that's going on, to get a little more technical, is when they weaponize this stuff the way I just described, it's coming out of the envelope like a gas. What's always been key to the American offensive program, including before Nixon terminated the offensive program in 1969, the key additive is silicon. That's what they use. Okay, no problem. When you look at anthrax weaponization projects before 1969, which is the year that Nixon terminated the offensive program, and you look at how anthrax has been weaponized since, in parentheses, in violation of the Bioweapons International Arms Control Treaty, end of parentheses, all of these programs, American programs, this is characteristic of the American program, because there are other additives that could be used, but the one the Americans use, the one we have patents on, is the additive silicon, the element silicon. Now, there's different compounds involving silicon. What I'm about to say about silicon is that the FBI for, well, this went down in September of 2001, and we don't find out what the percentage of the silicon was in the attack anthrax until 2010, when the FBI, retreating from a full-scale reinvestigation, gets it into its head to employ the National Academy of Sciences to look only at the science and make no overall conclusions. And in amongst the 9,000 pages the NAS managed to secure from the FBI, I guess somebody was napping that day when it was stuck in the pile, has the percentages. Now, these percentages of silicon in the attack anthrax, I mean, I followed it, okay? This is my job. My job is to follow all the FBI statements about silicon starting in 2001, right? The first thing is not what you expect, and I probably ought to spend some time on. Let's begin on September 4, 2001. Front page, New York Times, three authors. Broad, the science editor. Miller, we all know who Miller is. And then Engelberger, who ended up at Frontline. And what they're doing on September 4, 2001, is they're revealing the existence of, up until then, top secret anthrax weaponization projects. And not only are they revealing the existence of them, but they're telling us what their names are, that is the names of the projects, their ostensible functions are, and who's doing them and where they're doing them. On September 4, 2001, 14 days before the first letter is postmarked. Now, in thinking about this as I have over the years, it doesn't occur to me until lately that that's pretty strange. In fact, it's not strange. What it causes me to think is that there's a tussle going on, and somebody close to the source of all this is feeding something to the New York Times that the New York Times is seeing fit to run with. The problem is, we're not running with anything. And this is what I mean. You've got the exposure of anthrax weaponization projects on the front page of the New York Times on September 4, 2001. And except for this punk, nobody wants to connect that up with the anthrax attacks. Well, that is starting to change. But if you had to boil down my contribution, that's all it is. That's all it is. We got the anthrax weaponization projects. We've got this extremely sophisticated anthrax. Put it together, because once you put it together, and there's no choice, then you read the article, right? And they tell you who's doing it and where it's happening. I'll tell you right now what it says. The CIA is conducting a project, an anthrax weaponization project called Clear Vision. They are quoted as saying that their idea behind the project is to look into the future of bioweapons. Do you know what that means? I can get very specific. Looking into the future of bioweapons, by way of broad brush first, the technology is now readily available. They're talking about doing genetic engineering in high school labs, and we're beyond that. Now we're in synthetic. That means you actually put the genes together with molecules. So when you look into the future of bioweapons, what you're looking at is creating germ for which there is neither vaccine nor cure. And then you're trying to figure out how best to distribute them. And for good measure, if you get the formula right, they'll be contagious. The 2001 anthrax is bad enough, but we haven't slowed down. And it's happening, actually, in my backyard. We're watching it happen. It's a statement that I repeat every opportunity I get. I'll read it to you. Only massive delusion can explain how we could accept that the necessary response to the anthrax attacks of 2001, the only bio attack in our history, is to recklessly expand the program that itself generated the attack. In other words, the official account is this came out of our program. Of course it did. They knew that in early October, before even the first victim died. It's our strain. It's the AIM strain. That's the first thing that they figured out. This strain of anthrax is our strain. We've given it to Porton Down in England. We gave it to that facility up in Canada, but that's it. This is domestic, and it came out of our program. And in fact, let's not forget, the official account is that Bruce Ivins was solely responsible for the anthrax attacks. He works at the Army Biodefense Facility in Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, where I live. His house is about a mile and a half from mine. I've met with his wife. I've met with his daughter. He was an immunologist. He didn't even work with the stuff. When I say he didn't work with it, this is a dry powder. Before you even start talking about additives, I've just never seen anything like it. For that matter, even the few that know something about it had never seen anything like it. When they first opened it up in the lab at Fort Detrick, there was international press there. I've stood in front of the window myself. They gave me a presidential tour once. The scientist opens up the envelope further, and then Marilyn Harrington, current manager of the Washington Post, one of the editorial managers, writes in her book, The Killer Strain, after interviewing the scientist involved, his name is John Azell, I've met with him a number of times, including been at his house and sat on his porch. She tells the story, after interviewing Azell, that he is aghast at what this stuff is. The end of the chapter, he goes up to a sink in the lab and prepares a bleach mixture and snorts it, knocked himself out snorting it. And that was 2001 technology, and they haven't missed a beat. Look, the Bush administration is planning this expansion from the beginning. At the same time as it's planning this expansion of so-called biodefense program, it's in Geneva at the International Arms Control Conference announcing that the United States is no longer interested in even talking about inspections and verification. Understand, Clinton's appointee for 10 years dilly-dallied, but the first thing the Bush administration does, I mean it was very early on, is we're not even interested. The September 4, 2001 article that I referred to in the New York Times specifically said that the reason the Bush administration didn't want inspections and verification is because that would have opened up to inspection the facilities at Battelle and Dugway. So let me say those two words again three times. Battelle and Dugway, Battelle and Dugway, Battelle and Dugway. Dugway is the facility in the Utah desert, about 80 miles from Salt Lake City. It's been CBW headquarters, apart from Detrick. Detrick's the headquarters. This is where the volume goes on. Before 1969, this is where they're producing large quantities of bioweapons and chemical weapons, CBW. The Dugway Proving Ground in Utah is bigger than the state of Rhode Island. The Dugway Proving Ground, Army, this Army facility, admits early on after Amerithrax, after the anthrax attacks, that it has weaponized anthrax. As Dr. Barbara Rosenberg stated over and over again in the early part of this, that's never been admitted before. Now, let me recapitulate. We first figure out, no problem, this is a domestic strain. And early on, we recognize and in fact make very clear through the mainstream media that it's an extremely advanced weaponization design. And I've got the Baltimore Sun on December 12, 2001. I've got the Washington Post on December 13, 2001. I've got the New York Times on December 16, 2001. I've got the Miami Herald on December 21, 2001. And they all basically say the same thing. Though they don't refer to the anthrax weaponization projects, they all say this is very advanced. It corresponds with what we now know the Army and the intelligence agencies was working on. That is our best lead. And then they say, this stuff was either made, I'm saying this is what it said in all these newspapers, this stuff was either made at Dugway or at the facilities owned and operated by Battelle Memorial Laboratories. That's why I repeated the phrase, Dugway and Battelle, Dugway and Battelle, Dugway and Battelle, because Dugway is the Army facility. Battelle is the largest private research and development corporation in the world. And the reason you haven't heard about it is because they don't want you to know about it. It's got more than 20,000 employees. It's got a huge national security division. It manages and operates all of the intelligence agency biolabs. And for that matter, it also manages and operates the biolabs at Dugway. And they're in the thick of the anthrax weaponization projects, without a doubt. The source of the anthrax, we'll talk about perpetrators in a moment, but the source of the anthrax itself, this highly advanced AIM strain, silicon-coated germ, came out of a lab managed or operated by Battelle. What distinguishes anthrax attacks from 9/11 is that this is now, it not only started out mainstream, but it's becoming mainstream again. Let me mention how it's becoming mainstream again. For one thing, of course, you have the revulsion against the Ivins case. Totally absurd case. Totally absurd, stupid, lousy, no evidence. All the evidence contradicts it. Stupid case, which I might throw in, is the clear cause of the death of Bruce Ivins. I happen to believe Bruce Ivins committed suicide. There's questions that could be raised, but I happen to believe he did it. I mean, speaking to his wife and daughter, for one thing. But I will tell you that we're talking about a fragile man with a psychiatric background being treated by psychiatrists. And the pressure was intense. I mean, they just broke him down. They moved in next door. They were 24/7. They were living next door for months. The FBI was next door for months. And he had some embarrassing things, and they started to uncover them, and he just fell apart. Of course, they barred him from his life's work was the meaning of his life. They barred him from there, of course. And he just broke down. I mean, just steadily broke down and probably did commit suicide. Had absolutely nothing to do with the anthrax attacks. No way in the world. Let me give you an example of just how exposed this is. The first victim of the anthrax attacks, his name was Robert Stevens. Just for a quick show, this is a while ago. How many people in this room know the name Robert Stevens? I want to know. Oh, wow. How about that? Okay, well, if it was 10 years ago, everybody would know the name because he's the first one that dies from the anthrax. Robert Stevens' family sues the United States of America for negligent handling of anthrax and Bruce Ivins, and if he was so crazy, what was he doing there, and why weren't you keeping track and all this? So listen to this now. This is too much. The Civil Division of the Department of Justice defending the United States against the claim of Robert Stevens puts in writing and files with the court statements that go like this. The equipment to produce this stuff is not at Fort Detrick. The technology to produce this stuff is not at Fort Detrick. The expertise necessary to produce this stuff is not at Fort Detrick. That's what the Civil Division of the DOJ said. And maybe it's a reflection of the quality of this enemy of ours, because only after they file it is it brought to their attention that they just kicked in the stomach the DOJ Criminal Division's myth. So do you know what they do? I'm a lawyer, right? So I followed this. 4 days later, they file with the court. They called it a notice of errata. I'm not pronouncing it right. E-R-R-A-T-A, otherwise known as whoops. And I liked it. I mean, it didn't last long, but the judge, you know what the judge's response was? I'm not accepting this. I'm not accepting this. He did that for a while. Eventually, he accepted it. I mean, it's that simple, folks. It's that simple. We know what the technology is, and we know where the technology was being done. I said CIA. Defense Intelligence Agency also has a project. It's either happening at Dugway or the labs in West Jefferson, Ohio. We know that. Okay, so it's a little different than 9/11 because this is mainstream now. It's coming back to the mainstream partly because of Barbara Rosenberg, who I've already mentioned, and a couple of other scientists, one who is recognized to be probably the world's authority on bacteriology, that's Hugh Jones in New Orleans, Martin. He's in on this too. And basically what they did was they took these documents that had been suppressed by the FBI and they looked closely at them. And what they found was not only the percentages of the silicon that the FBI had been obfuscating, pretending like it didn't know, lowballing and everything else, not only did they look at the extent of the silicon in the attack anthrax, but they discovered something else. They discovered the element tin also in the attack anthrax. And what's so telltale about tin is, if the tin is in the growth medium, and the anthrax, while it's growing, picks up the tin, it dies, which proves that the tin was added. And then what you got is, you've got percentages of silicon and percentages of tin that, in the same proportion as a technology called microencapsulation. Microencapsulation. But what's going on here is this. Microencapsulation's been around for a long time. It's been used in the pharmaceutical industry and for very clear purposes, including to promote dispersibility into the lungs. But no one had ever heard of it being applied to bioweapons until, fairly recently, when I say the establishment scientists, this is what I mean. When they come out with this, they get front page coverage in the New York Times. They've got that. That's who they are. They get front page coverage in the New York Times. William Broad does the piece. He sticks in there. I mean, he hides it, but it's in there. And this is what he gives us. William Broad, this is 2011, he says, after a discussion of the silicon tin. Well, he says, if Bruce Ivins didn't do this, maybe it's time for us to start looking at the CIA and the military's anthrax projects.
Yeah. Good going, Bill. I actually went up to see him the next week. He gave me an appointment and everything. It's very interesting to go up there. You know, one of the things that kind of fueled my activism through this, I had this impression, which I think is a pretty valid one. When you go to Congress, right, the reality they're working from, you hear it over and over again in these committees, is they're either quoting from the New York Times or they're quoting from the Washington Post, you know, maybe the LA Times and Miami Herald, McClatchy. But basically, to my eyes, that is the reality we're working with. I start confronting these journalists. I'm saying to myself, if I can get Scott Shane, the correspondent for the New York Times, to write the truth, the evident truth, I've skipped a lot of steps. Because people don't have time for this. Folks, you're beautiful. I love every one of you. You're fantastic activists. You don't even know who Robert Stevens is. I mean, of course not. You do now, that's right. He's the first, you know, he's the first one. Let me tell you who the next two were, just to sort of hammer this point home. The next two are mail workers at Brentwood. They kept the damn post office open. They know this stuff is flying around. They know this stuff is flying around. They want business as usual. That's what they want. So we lose a bunch of them. I can't tell you the exact number. Come down with inhalational anthrax. That's a difficult thing to survive, folks. Two of them don't make it. Now, what happened there? Again, back to understanding what a bioweapons arms race is. These two postal workers are killed only as the result of this anthrax addressed to the senators getting through the pores of the paper of the envelope. The seams are taped. Remember, this is an inside job. Not exactly something a terrorist would do. You don't tape the seams, do you? Look, so let me be clear about this. There's a whole lot here I haven't barked on, and I really do want to make reference to it. I want to give credit to Barbara Honegger, who did wonderful work before she was more focused on the Pentagon. Her article, Scarlet A, is all about the connections between the anthrax attacks and 9/11. The other wonderful source on what I'm about to make reference to is Dr. Graham McQueen, the founder of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. And he and I have been talking a lot in the last couple of weeks, and he was kind enough to give me an advanced copy of his booklet. And he's not coming at this from the technological side and the silicon and the tin and the weaponization and who does the weaponization. What his focus is, very interestingly, is he's looking at what the media are saying in the run-up to the anthrax attacks and then thereafter. I hope I can get this across, because this is just another one of those smoking guns. I mean, it's another one of the things that really, if we were being objective, we would just look at and say, okay, the whole story is in that. The whole story is in that. We don't need any more details. You can tell the whole story in that. Okay, so let me give you an example. Actually, before the anthrax attacks, they started up with, tell me if anybody remembers this. The name, I think, is Al-Hawazni, one of the hijackers on 93. Well, so what they come up with is, listen to this now. They come up with Al-Hawazni went into the emergency room at Fort Lauderdale in June of 2001 with a lesion on his leg. And then after the anthrax attacks, the doctor who treated him at the emergency room says, you know, once I heard about the anthrax attacks, I went back to my notes and now I realize that was anthrax. And then they get the Johns Hopkins University Center for Biodefense, whatever, and they say, we've interviewed the doctor and we agree. The only thing we can see this being consistent with is a case of cutaneous anthrax. Now, I got a much better story than that one. But before I do, let's just make sure that everybody appreciates what we're describing here. Well, obvious, right? We're trying to link 9/11 with the anthrax attacks, right? Everybody gets that. We got a hijacker with an anthrax infection. But what happens when it becomes irrefutable, uncontroversial, universally recognized that the anthrax attacks is an inside job? What happens then? What happens then? Well, we don't hear any more about the lesion. That's not going to do any good. In fact, it's probably not necessary to spell it out. It does quite the opposite, doesn't it? But I got a better story for you. We know this stuff came out of top secret anthrax weaponization projects because of the technology involved, okay? And I can get much more specific than that, but that's broad brush. And we know where the anthrax weaponization projects are being carried out. In fact, it's reported in the mainstream media, both before the anthrax attacks and afterwards. And I want to be very, very clear about what's revealed. But I want to use this word, this broad word, because if you want to remember anything I said, during this speech, this is the one thing you need to remember. What we have in the mainstream in December of 2001 and now again, full square, is that the anthrax attacks came out of our military-industrial intelligence complex. That's it. It's different than 9/11. One of the reasons it's different than 9/11, one of the reasons that's so on the surface, is that the way they tried to cover this up was they had to incriminate another facet of the complex. And that other facet of the complex is fighting back in public, even though all the scientists at USAMRIID to this day have a gag order. As soon as anybody gets out of there, and a lot of them have been very anxious to do so, they're blabbing. I've been on this radio show a bunch of times. The guy, Henry Heiner, worked with Bruce Ivins. The last day at Dietrich, I'm saying it was his last day. He went in the morning of the last day. He was still working there. He went in the morning and got on that radio show. He said like this. This is what he said. This is what Henry Heiner said. Bruce Ivins grows anthrax in a shaker flask. He doesn't even have a fermenter. It would have taken him a year and a half to grow this much anthrax. You think he could do that without anybody noticing? Dry powder? Ivins doesn't know anything about dry powder. We don't have this technology. We don't do that at Fort Detrick. We don't have that equipment. We don't have that technology. Nobody had ever seen this before. I mean, that's what he's doing. It's still his last day. And there's a couple of others that went to the University of Wyoming, and they're saying the same thing. What sets this off is that we have in the mainstream, very, very clearly, that our military-industrial intelligence complex committed what is officially recognized to be an inside false flag attack. You understand what I mean by false flag attack in this context. The letters, please don't forget, all of them have different language, but they all say this: death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. And they didn't just frame al-Hosni. It's amazing to me that they could think something as stupid as I'm about to describe could convince anybody in this transparent effort to marry 9/11 and anthrax. They have Mohammed Atta all the way up to the Saturday before September 11 going into this crop dusting company in northern Miami with some other Mideastern men, probably hijackers he didn't recognize, and they're just, you know, need to know about crop dusters. Of course, the whole thing's been set up, because what you've got going into it is you've got all this, you got Ashcroft getting up there and talk. He went to Congress. It was on September 24th, and this is how he testified. He said, and we've got to be worried about crop dusters, because we know Iraq and Al-Qaeda, both of them, are using crop dusters to distribute bioweapons. This is set up. It's a setup. So they got Atta going into this. This was done in detail. Actually, they did this in detail on ABC News. Brian Ross was a real villain of the piece. In June of 2002, they're still doing this. It's long after we know that it couldn't possibly be a foreign source for this. And they've got, this is the interview. United States Department of Agriculture. Atta comes in. He wants a $650,000 loan for a big plane because he wants to be able to do the crop dusting in one fell swoop. She says to him, he's very, very clear. He gives her his name, spells it for her. I mean, Mohammed Atta. I mean, it's very good. And then she says to him, she says, you don't think you can just walk in here and walk out with $650,000 in cash? And this is exactly what he says to her. He says, well, what would you do? This is Atta speaking to her. What would you do if I came around your desk and slit your throat and then took the money out of the safe? This is Atta, you know, in the middle of his top secret operation. Now listen to this, this goes on and on. He sees an aerial photograph of Washington, D.C. on her wall and starts putting money down. He wants to buy it because he's very interested, not only in the aerial photograph, but in security associated therewith. I mean, this is what he's saying to her. He then goes on to say, and also, how about the World Trade Center in New York? What's the security like there? I'm telling you. And then before he leaves, he has occasion to say, not explicitly, but certainly imply, I'm a member of Al-Qaeda. I mean, he's talking about Al-Qaeda. And then he adds to that, and oh, by the way, you might not know the name Osama bin Laden, but he's going to be viewed as a hero sooner rather than later. I mean, come on. What is Mohammed Atta doing in a crop dusting company on the Saturday before September 11, when what? He's a suicide bomber in a few days? Or what are you doing? What is this? No, everybody's laughing. But I mean, look, it's a terrible enemy. I don't know what to do about these people. I don't. I'm afraid, and I don't want to be pessimistic, all right? But I think something that we might want to just allow to cross our minds. This is the stage we're at. We could convince everybody. I don't know that it helps. I don't know that it helps. This Syria thing terrifies me. This thing is going much faster than I could even imagine. They just did Libya. Take a look at that building.
He's referring here to the Pentagon, which was in plain view from the conference room windows.
That building, pound for pound, that's a nasty place. That is a nasty place. That's a nasty place. That's a nasty place.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.